I was married from the womb, and I'll die in marriage.
Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Defender 7 Tuesday Night Medical Broadcast with your host and our colonel, Kimberly Purvis. Welcome, y'all. Before we get on with our show, I need to read our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Defender 7 radio show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. That being said, again, welcome. Those of you new just tuning in to us, we also have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, with two small I's, .com. On there, you'll find that we have a store and a donate button. 100% of all proceeds from sales from our store and any donations we bring in go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. This is the only way that we're able to fund what we are about and what we do here at the Defender 7. So please, by all means, purchase something. Give us an idea of other things you'd like to see in the store to sell. But help us to help you and our communities, especially during disaster relief. It's another big part of what we're about. We can be reached on our national Facebook page by typing in the search box, all capital letters, Defenders 7. That's Defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, with two large I's. Now, just know that before you click on that join button, we expect all of our members and future members to participate in everything we do throughout the whole Defender 7 group. We're not just a Facebook group. We're not armchair warriors. We're the real deal. And we do need participation. We're trying to build sectors in all 50 states and have been since our inception, January 19, 2019. Now, if you get in and you feel you can't participate or don't want to be a part of us, you can always leave. No hard feelings. We treat everybody as one big extended family. We're also on MeWe. If you click on organizations and scroll down to Defender 7, Humanitarian Patriot Group. We're also on YouTube. So please, by all means, look us up on YouTube and click that subscribe button. Every like, every subscription helps us to help you. Now for tonight and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio. We enjoy it when you call and participate. And that number to call is area code 914-205-5773. Again, the number to call to participate or just listen. Area code 914-205-5773. And I will now be opening up the phone line, so come on in, folks. Come talk to our Colonel Kimberly Purvis and myself, General Bobby Ormsby. Evening, Kimberly.
Good evening.
How you feeling,
kid?
If
I sound half dead and lifeless, that's because I am. I feel like a child when they get sick. You know, when they get a fever, they're lifeless. They lay down, they nap. And when the fever goes away just long enough, they run around and blow all their energy and they crash again. That's how I feel right now. Starting Saturday. And I haven't eaten since Saturday. Okay. So one, that always takes a toll on someone's body. Oh, excuse me. I've got the belching that I have is from the gastritis, and it sucks. Pray to God you never get it. But I finally was able to eat two eggs this morning, scrambled eggs, right, with nothing in it, nothing at all. And I was like, okay with that. And so basically what happens is I lay down for an hour, I get up for like 15, 20 minutes, and then crash for another half hour, 45 minutes. And I just lay there. I don't have to go to sleep. It's just, I don't know, there's something about laying flat when you're sick compared to sitting in your chair, like a recliner. But I took the chicken breast that I have, and I put them in the crock pot, and I cooked them, and I'm like, oh, God. I dread this because the smell is killing me. But I actually was able to eat a half of one, which was too much. I should have only ate about a quarter of it, but I'm telling you, it's brutal having gastritis.
I bet.
So needless to say, I think I figured out, or the doctors think they figured out what's been my problem for the last few months. I think it's malabsorption that I have because of my celiac, but not only did they just butcher my diet, I was just crawl under a rock and die and get it over with. I can no longer eat. I don't eat fried vegetables anyway, but like dried fruit, where's it at? Cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, rutabaga, sauerkraut, peppers, onions, cabbage, corn, and coconut. Shoot me now. I hate coconut anyway. But not only that, I mean, not to mention no lunch meats, no hot dogs, no processed meat. I should show you a copy of this. They literally just butchered the rest of my diet that I can't eat anyway. And then they told me, oh, now you can't eat regular potatoes or white rice. Wow, I can't have pasta. So now you just took the only two other things that I could eat. But they told me if I eat sweet potatoes, that'd be fine. And like jasmine rice or brown rice, I'll be okay. Everything that I've been eating like that has been adding to the inflammation of my stomach, which is why my stomach swells every time I eat. Had no idea that most of the stuff I was eating that's normally healthy to you or anybody else, it's not to me. So, I don't know. I guess I'll drink water and eat cardboard for the rest of my life. I mean,
speaking of nut jobs, Captain from Wisconsin, Lorna Munson's on with us.
Oh, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Well, you can eat dandelions.
I don't know. They'll probably come up with a problem with that. I swear to God. Well, see, here's the thing. I knew when I was going, when I went into the hospital, they were going to give me a GI cocktail. Okay, it's disgusting, but it works. but here's the problem. This is so bad. This episode of gastritis for me is so bad that it only lasted about 2 to 3 hours. That was it. Normally it would last me like 6, 7, 8 hours. Now this was done after a couple hours. And then it took almost an hour for it to even start working. So I'm like, screw this shit. I can't keep suffering. So I went and bought a bottle of cherry flavored Maalox. Screw the chalk. I am not eating chalk flavored. So to stop the fire in my stomach, I got to take the Maalox 4 times a day. You know what the side effect is? Now my intestines are clear. I've got nothing in my intestines. So now
growing
my
out,
ass is on fire. Oh, my God. My ass is on fire. It's like pouring alcohol on a cut. I mean, it's that. I hate to say TMI, but I hate it. It's a medical show. But, you know, Lauren, I don't know if you've ever had this problem of excessive diarrhea. When I mean excessive, I mean every time you go. You have to lean forward to pee so it doesn't go back and touch your ass. I hate to be so graphic. Oh, my God. That's how bad it is. Literally. So I stopped taking the Maalox today because it's kind of calmed down. But I got to water down my Gatorade and Powerade drinks because it's just too much on my stomach. So I don't know. So hopefully I'm probably going to, like, crash after the show and go to bed at 9. Oh, I just lay there for a couple hours, get up, lay back down for a couple hours, get back up. And that's the way it is. So, before we get started, everyone pray for the people in Goma, Africa. I don't know if you guys heard about the volcano that erupted. 2 million people have been displaced out of their houses. It's one of the most active and dangerous volcanoes there is. And I guess it's pretty bad over there. They people were walking. They have all their belongings, so they're just walking out of town. Some of the main roads were closed. The airport got saved. It just stopped literally like a mile from the airport. The lava flow. So. But other than that, oh, and today is my doggie's birthday. She's 2.
Cool. Happy birthday.
Yes,
happy birthday.
She's rotten. Yesterday it was my birthday. What a way to spend it. 6. Yay. I'll survive. So we left off in 1925. With the vaccine. And so in 1925, smallpox hit Milwaukee. An epidemic hit Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was reported that 386 cases came out and 87 died. And of the rest, the 327 had never been vaccinated. 46 of those had been. And 10 or more of those vaccines was like, I mean, they were vaccinated like 10 or more years beforehand. So during the epidemic, about 400,000 people got vaccinated during the epidemic. And, of course, people were – there was a forced quarantine or something like that, of course. Dr. Merle R. French, a 1921 graduate of the University of Iowa School of Medicine, was at the time of the outbreak the superintendent of Communicable Diseases Hospital in Milwaukee. Dr. French wrote a note describing one of the patients pictured there, and it's a pretty bad case of smallpox. He was a Christian scientist who thought that he could, by the power of the mind, prevent smallpox. He died. I guess his mind wasn't that strong, or it was just that bad. And he ended up dying from it. Dr. French was referring to variola major, the more dangerous form of smallpox, rather than variola minor, which came to be the dominant form of smallpox in the 20th century, particularly in the West, as where most of the people had that. This man seems to have suffered from a type of variola major. Oh, he had hemorrhagic smallpox, which is pretty deadly. And about 22 people got the hemorrhagic in that epidemic. And hemorrhagic smallpox is usually fatal. So, unfortunately. All right. In 1925, an outbreak of diphtheria in Alaska led to the famous Ninana Tenomdar. One of the sled dogs. They called it the Great Race of Mercy because I guess that's what her name was. Curtis Welch, a physician in Nome, saw several children die of what he first thought was tonsillitis. As more children reported sore throats, he observed the white pseudomembrane of diphtheria, which had no fresh antitoxin on hand. So he had only expired antitoxin because the shipment had been ordered in 1924, had not arrived. So he sent a telegram requesting mail delivery of the antitoxin, and a hospital in Anchorage had 300,000 units of antitoxin, and it was shipped by train, 674 miles from Nome is where they had to ship it to. The shipment would need to be traveled by dog sled to reach the children of Nome. The journey of 20 teams of mushers and sled dogs from Ninana to Nome transfixed the country. The mushers battled near record low temperatures along the way, and they had to periodically stop to warm the serum. Many dogs died during the trip, and a lot of the mushers got frostbite from it. The antitoxin reached Nome on February 2nd when Welch used it to treat the many sick children in the hospital. He reported that 5 children had died from it, but it could have been a lot worse had they not had the dogs. Togo and Balto, 2 of the lead sled dogs, received national attention, and a statue of Balto still stands in Central Park in New York City. I wonder if that's where they got that dog. You know the movie Balto? I think it's a Disney movie. If that's where they got it from. Oh, hush.
I think there is a movie after that. That sounds very familiar to me.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if that was after that dog Balto. I never saw it, but yeah. I mean, that's what they used. in Alaska. Hell, that's all they got.
Right.
In 1925, whooping cough, conflicting reports of vaccine success. Thorvald Madsen, a Danish physician, tested his pertussis vaccine in children in the Faroe Islands. The vaccine seemed to provide protection against the disease. However, another one of his studies published in 1933 reported that two children died from what may have been reactions to the vaccine. See, vaccines are a good thing. Don't get me wrong. I mean, but not everybody is going to be protected by it. There are things that's in vaccines that people can be allergic to. I, for one, unfortunately, have found a bunch of them. And it's like the flu, the regular flu vaccine that we've been getting every year. They say if you're allergic to eggs or shit, what was it? Eggs or something else, that you can't get the flu vaccine. So, I mean, and I think that's an unfortunate thing, and that's how they found out a lot of these allergies. In 1926, Glennie develops an adjuvant. Alexander Thomas Glennie increased the effectiveness of diphtheria toxoid by treating it with aluminum salt. Efforts to improve diphtheria toxoid were necessary because toxoid alone produced a lower level of antibody response than desired. Moreover, the immunity it produced was shorter than it was shorter lived. Observing that animals achieved better immunity to diphtheria when the injected toxoid created a local inflammatory reaction, Glennie began to add substances to the toxoid to trigger such a response. Today, we call these substances adjuvants, and they are used in several types of vaccines. And unfortunately, sometimes there are things added that, like mercury. They use a tiny bit of mercury in vaccines to prevent contamination of the rest of them in the vial. Yes, you're not supposed to have mercury, but there's mercury in fish that you eat, depending on the lake and or river that you get them. I don't know about you guys. I know in Tennessee there's a lake that actually says you're only allowed to consume so many catfish, so many bass, so many of this and that and the other because of the amount of mercury that's in the water. So, I mean, it tells you right there. So, unfortunately, you get what you're not supposed to. In 1926, the Metropolitan Life Diphtheria Campaign started. Metropolitan Life, the insurance company, launched its anti-diphtheria campaign in New York, and it donated $15,000 to the effort. Louis Dublin, a MetLife statistician, estimated that childhood diseases, including diphtheria, cost the American economy about $200 million a year, lost in parental wages and medical costs. That's a lot for 1926. $200 million a year in lost wages. For parents' wages, for, you know, having to stay home with their kids. That's a lot of money for back then. MetLife used door-to-door polling, radio, and print advertisements, essay contests, parades, and more to spread the immunization message. All right, now. My computer's being retarded. It won't let me. There we go. But, unfortunately, in 1926, the opposition to vaccination grows. Despite vaccination success against smallpox, opposition to vaccination continued through the 20s. particularly against compulsory vaccination. In 1926, a group of health officers visited Georgetown, Delaware, to vaccinate the townspeople. A retired Army lieutenant and a city councilman led an armed mob to force them out. And they ended up stopping the vaccination attempt. People have come a long way towards most of our vaccinations. In 1927, Bezredka's Bila vaccine for cholera. Alexandra Bezredka's oral Bila vaccine was tested in India and China alongside an injected vaccine. The Bila vaccine, so-called because it employed Bila salt, was effective as the other vaccine. However, the bile salt caused diarrhea, speak of the devil, which led some to conclude that the vaccine was in fact causing cholera. Bezredka's Bila vaccine was given in doses on 3 successive days and consisted of a bile tablet followed by a tablet containing cholera vibrio. See, back then, like we've gone over from when vaccines first started, yes, cholera is diarrhea, but a lot of things cause that. So, but, you know, you learn as you go. In 1927, diphtheria strikes young Heilman. 8-year-old Maurice Heilman nearly died from diphtheria, a disease that would later be virtually eradicated in the United States through immunization. Cute little kid. In 1928, tuberculosis. The League of Nations recommends BCG. The Health Committee of the League of Nations adopted BCG as a recommended tuberculosis vaccine. And that's what we were talking about. I don't know if you guys remember a couple shows back about the COVID vaccine, about the BCG. That's what Dr. Phil was talking about. And that BCG is used for TB. But this is one thing I've tried to stress to people. TB is more contagious than COVID. Most TB patients have to be hospitalized
and put on medication for about 12 to 15 months.
Unless that's changed. Bobby, let me call you back because I've got an echo.
All right.
I don't know if you guys hear it or not. No,
I don't hear it.
Hold on.
You don't hear anything.
I hear everything.
No, you don't. You don't pay attention.
No, I'm echoing.
She's contagious.
She's back.
Okay. But like the TB. When I took care of a lot of TB patients, I could still hear myself. In Florida, when I worked at Jackson Hospital, the person is put in a negative pressure room, and you have to wear complete head-to-toe PPE. because that's how contagious it is. That's why I didn't understand why the people are wearing the same shit. Actually, they're wearing almost mop gear for COVID. I mean, there's, in all honesty, there was no need in that. I mean, they probably could have just got away with wearing the gown and your mask and gloves. But yeah, TB is a lot far worse than COVID, and about a million. I think it was roughly a million people died from TB the year before last. In America, not worldwide. And I'm sure that the TB rates in like Africa, India, are probably a lot higher because of their poor healthcare system that they have. So in 1928, the Queensland disaster happened. Bacterial contamination of diphtheria toxin, antitoxin, mixture in Bundaberg, Queensland, Australia, led to the deaths of 12 children, and five others became critically ill but recovered. And that's when the multi-use vial was used, and it had no preservative. See, that's what I was talking about, like the mercury. And back then, they could have used a different preservative. I don't know what they could have used. But that's the importance of small amounts of preservatives in the multivials. Now, in the individual, it's not important to have. Hold on one second. I gotta go let my deranged dogs outside. They won't stop whining. Or better yet, Pat's dog, he's just got gas like a friggin', I don't know what. Okay. Sorry about that. I just gotta multitask. Okay. So in 1929, the iron lung. Philip Drinker, PhD, and Charles McCann, MD, at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard published a paper describing successful use of an artificial respirator for patients suffering from paralytic polio. The machine, first known as the Drinker respirator and later as the iron lung, would provide temporary and in some cases permanent breathing support for people suffering from paralysis of the diaphragm and intercostal muscles, which are, you've got to have them for breathing or you die. The Drinker respirator was a sealed tube-like structure powered by electricity, and the patient's head extended from the tube, and the body with a rubber seal at the neck was entirely enclosed by the tube. Decreased pressure forced air into the lungs, and increased pressure was forced out. And today we have our modern-day ventilators. So, in 1929, they had the Lubbock disaster for tuberculosis. The disaster caused by the use of Bacillus Calmette-Guérin, the BCG, for tuberculosis vaccination, struck the German city of Lübeck. Sorry, it's Lübeck. During 1929 and 1930, 72 babies died from tuberculosis out of 252. That were vaccinated.
They still use BCG today in southern countries.
Oh, I know.
And a lot of times when we try to do a PPD on them, they convert positive, so we have to do the chest X-ray.
I knew you'd chime in sooner or later with the BCG because we talked about that.
Yep.
Many other infants were made ill as a result of the vaccination. The vaccine used was found to have been contaminated with a human tuberculosis strain being studied in the same lab where the vaccine was produced. Yeah, which is a good reason why they shouldn't do that. Now, I would like to say one thing about, we've been doing these, it's been taking us, what, Bobby, this is the fourth show on it?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Vaccines go back that far. I know there's been a lot, it's a trial and error. So just because there's a lot of, like, these incidents that happen, that doesn't mean vaccines are bad. They're very good, actually. But it's just, we're just going through where they started, and we will end up today on how they've completely evolved. In 1930, Max Seiler takes on yellow fever. Harvard instructor Max Seiler and colleagues proved that yellow fever virus could easily be given to mice. This was an important discovery given that although previous efforts resulted in the successful infection of monkeys, monkeys were difficult to work with and quite expensive. Mice, on the other hand, were easily to acquire and to handle. Seiler continued his work and joined the Rockefeller Foundation. Seiler incidentally contracted yellow fever himself from one of his own mice. Fortunately, he had suffered a mild case and developed immunity to the disease. Okay, in 1931, more than one type of polio virus proposed. Australian researchers Frank Burnett and Jean McNamara infected monkeys with polio from a fatal human case of the disease. The monkeys had recovered from a previous case of polio and yet were paralyzed by the new infection. Their work showed that there was more than one type of polio virus and that previous infection with the one type did not confer immunity to another type. The implication was clear. A polio vaccine would need to provide protection from all types. It would be 20 years before David Bodian and Isabel Morgan would demonstrate that there are three types of polio viruses. I had no clue. I thought there was just one. I knew there was the live, you know, the live drop, and then now they have the injection. But I had no idea there was more than one type of polio. In 1931, they found Hib linked to meningitis. American researcher Margaret Pittman classified different types of Haemophilus influenzae bacteria and found that strains caused meningitis had a capsule composed of a specific polysaccharide, a form of a carbohydrate that has many sugars linked together. Of those strains, Pittman found that type B called Hib for Haemophilus influenza type B caused nearly all cases of Haemophilus influenza meningitis. It would later be confirmed that Hib could also cause many other serious diseases, including infections of the blood, bone, and joints. I got a question about meningitis. What was the difference between the bacterial and the viral meningitis as to which one is the worst one to have? Would you know, Dr. Phil?
In my opinion, I believe that the bacterial meningitis is going to be the worst one because as bacteria overpopulates, it starts growing and growing and growing and growing. And so not only do you have inflammation of the meninges of the brain, that's where they get the term meningitis from, you also have space-occupying mass within the brain, so you have compounded. The virus doesn't expand like the bacteria does. You can grow the bacteria in the petri dish and make a big old flower out of it, whereas the virus, it usually sheds and it travels. gets out of different place. So meningitis is a medical term for inflammation of the meninges of the brain, and it can be caused by virus, bacteria, or traumatic inflammation as well.
Oh, okay. Because my son's friend got bacterial meningitis. I think it was bacterial. She got sick. 3 days later, she died. They didn't even have time to diagnose her with anything and found out that's what she had was meningitis. And that's why I was wondering if it's the bacterial or the viral.
Well, meningococcal is the bacteria that everyone has to go and get their vaccine before they go to college now. It's the meningococcal vaccine causing bacterial meningitis. So I think that might answer your question. Viral meningitis kills you too. Don't get me wrong.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
The one that we have the vaccine for is for the bacteria.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because he went to Tabor here in Kansas. And that one particular summer, they had an epidemic would be, yeah, because quite a few students got sick with meningitis that summer that he was in school here. And that was 8 years ago, I think. And I believe 8 students died that summer from it.
Yeah, it's deadly.
In 1933, influenza virus was isolated. British scientists Wilson Smith, C.H. Andrews, and P.P. Laidlaw isolated the influenza virus. Widespread influenza in early 1933 gave these scientists the chance to demonstrate the cause of the disease. They took throat washings from patients with influenza symptoms and filtered them through material that bacteria could not pass through. They tested the washings for the presence of bacteria by trying to culture them in a variety of media. The washings proved not to contain any detectable bacteria. Then they tried to infect a variety of animals with throat washings. Ferrets became ill about 3 days after exposure and displayed typical symptoms of influenza. Other ferrets became ill when exposed to the ferrets with the influenza, either via direct contact or when inoculated with nasal washings. The researchers also demonstrated a finding crucial for future vaccine development. Ferrets in humans who had recovered from influenza produced antibodies to the virus. Thus, Smith, Andrews, and Laidlaw's work indicated that influenza immunization might be possible. To this day, ferrets remain an important animal model for understanding influenza in humans. In 1935, diphtheria toxoid immunization became more widespread during the 1930s, but use of toxin-antitoxin mixture persisted. During this time, some confusion existed among parents and physicians about the need for booster doses and whether immunization was achieved after 1 or 2 doses. In 1935, early polio vaccine trials started. This year, 2 separate teams were at work developing and testing a polio vaccine. Both projects came to a disastrous end. At New York University, Maurice Brody, a young researcher, prepared a killed poliovirus vaccine, testing it on chimpanzees on himself and finally on children. He enrolled about 11,000 individuals in both control and vaccine groups on his trial. Meanwhile, John Comer of Temple University in Philadelphia developed an attenuated polio virus, which he tested on about 10,000 children. The test proved a disaster. Several subjects died of polio, and many were paralyzed.
Bobby, children are good for something.
I know. Good God. See? I'm surprised they tested it on the kids.
Yeah, first you check on the monkeys, and then you test it on the kids.
I know. The same difference, right, little monkeys? Some of the kids were made ill or suffered allergic reactions to the vaccines. I mean, as they come up with all the vaccines, you know, throughout time, they're going to change on how they're made and things like that. But it's still important to get them. In 1936, they started growing poliovirus in human nervous tissue. At the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, researchers Peter Olitsky and Albert Sabin demonstrated a new cultivation method for poliovirus. They were able to grow the virus in human embryonic brain tissue. Through their finding was interesting to researchers, it would not lead to immediate practical application. Researchers had long known that making a vaccine from virus breed and nervous system tissues prevented challenges. The risk came from possible damage to the vaccine recipient's nervous system. A lot of these vaccines, it's taken 30 years plus on a bunch of these?
Yep.
And,
yeah, well, you know, it got down to the average length of time was 10 years.
Yeah.
To develop a vaccine, and we did it in 4 months.
It's between 10 and 15, I guess, depending on the actual vaccine itself. So in 1936, Max Seiler finally developed the yellow fever vaccine. He and his colleagues developed a live attenuated vaccine for yellow fever using tissue cultures prepared from embryonated chicken eggs among the many subcultures of the yellow fever virus in the laboratory. The one designated 17G was used, giving the vaccine its name. He published results of U.S. vaccine trials to humans in 1937. The vaccine was easily adapted for mass production and became the universal standard. So that must be why they started telling people if you're allergic to eggs, you can't take that one particular vaccine.
Well, it's egg protein, actually, because they cultivate and grow the viruses in an embryo of a chicken.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
but it's the egg protein. If you can eat the yellow part of the egg, you're fine. If you can eat the white part of the egg, you're allergic to the white part of the egg, then that's where you're probably going to have problems. But if you're allergic to the yellow part of the egg, you can still get the virus. I mean, get it's not a contraindication,
the vaccine,
but it's the egg protein.
Yeah, I just know that every time I got a flu shot, they ask, are you allergic to eggs? No. Okay. I mean,
yeah,
the other most
common contraindications to most of the childhood vaccines are going to be gelatin. If you're allergic to gelatin, like Jell-O, gelatin is one of the things. If you're allergic to neomycin or streptomycin, those are also contraindications to certain vaccines. So those are the four main ones we look for. We look for the egg protein allergy, egg protein, gelatin, and streptomycin or neomycin allergies. And if you have those, then those are the contraindications to the main vaccines.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. In 1938, the March of Dimes was born. An enormous fundraising effort began when entertainer Eddie Cantor suggested on the radio that people send dimes to President Roosevelt at the White House to help fight polio. Within a few weeks, people had mailed almost 3 million dimes to the president. Other celebrities, then grassroots organizers, joined the campaign. Over the years, this March of Dimes raised tens of millions of dollars, much of which went to the effort to find a vaccine. I like doing the 5 mile, I do walk, I don't do run, for the March of Dimes. It's always a big thing when we lived in New Hampshire.
What has a 1,000 legs and can't walk? Jerry's Kids.
Oh, Jesus. That's dark.
Remember the Jerry Lewis telethon every year?
Yes. I used to watch him all the time.
Yeah, me too. I thought he was hilarious.
He raises quite a bit of money. And then...
but that was muscular dystrophy, though. That was kind of different than the March of Dimes.
Oh,
polio.
Yeah. In 1938... And then what?
Sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead and finish what you were saying.
I was thinking, do you remember carrying them little yellow, the little orange UNICEF containers around during Halloween?
Yeah.
Made a lot of money. Totally off subject. Sorry about that. But
oh, no.
Comes to mind.
Yeah, they've done a lot of fundraising for a lot of different illnesses. And that's when Dave Thomas, was it Dave Thomas? No.
Dave Thomas. Mary Tyler Moore.
Okay.
Yeah, Mary Tyler Moore.
I wasn't sure if it was the right time. Yeah, and that hospital. They must raise enough money for no child to have to pay for any treatment at all. I mean, because you got to pay the nurses and the doctors and everything else. And then for the child not to have to pay for any treatment. Is there only one facility, or is there more than one?
I don't know. Good question. Not me.
I'll have to find out.
I don't
In 1938, rubella, researchers demonstrate transmission of disease. Japanese scientist Kisaka and Hiro used throat washings from children sick with rubella to transmit the disease to healthy children. Well, the causative agent of the disease, however, remained unidentified. Well, no kidding, you're going to transmit it. Some of these ways, man, I'm telling you, I'm like, wow.
Kids are good for something.
I know, they are. They're like the remote control for your TV. I'm just kidding. Remember where you park your car when you go into a store. Shit, I could never remember. I didn't my kids remember. I used to tell them if they want to go inside, they're going to remember where I parked. In thanks for booting me.
He booted you?
Huh?
He booted you?
I don't know. I was in mid-sentence here about whooping cough and got hung up on.
It got completely quiet. I was wondering if I lost everybody.
Oh, no. It hasn't happened in a long time. So in 1939, the whooping cough vaccine has shown to be effective. American bacteriologist Pearl Kendrick and her colleague Grace Elderling at Michigan Department of Public Health published results of a landmark pertussis vaccine study. The two scientists demonstrated the effectiveness of a vaccine when compared with the controlled group that did not receive the vaccine. The annual attack rates per 100 children were 2.3 in the vaccinated group and 15.1 in the control group. Respectively, no deaths in either group. In addition, the disease was milder in the group that had been vaccinated. Yeah, whooping cough is nothing to play games with. In 1939, typhoid's role in warfare dwindles. While typhoid had killed thousands of soldiers in the Second Boer War and in the Spanish-American War, typhoid vaccination had a profound effect on its incidence in the following decades. U.S. Army Medical Department noted that during the Second World War, typhoid was nearly non-existent among American soldiers. And now that's why we stand in line and get thousands of shots. Or at least that's what it feels like. In 1940, a new type of influenza was isolated. Researchers had observed that the blood of some influenza patients did not react with antibodies to the influenza virus that an English team had isolated in 1933. Many, therefore, suspected that different types of influenza viruses existed. Thomas Francis Jr., then a researcher at Rockefeller University in New York City, obtained throat washings and blood samples from ill children at a nearby convalescent home for children. Antibodies from the blood samples did not react with a known influenza virus. Francis was able to infect ferrets with throat washings from one of the patients. Ferrets exhibited symptoms identical to the typical influenza symptoms. Other tests led Francis to conclude that he identified a new type of influenza virus. According to a classification system that other researchers had already proposed for any newly identified influenza type, Francis deemed the Lee virus influenza B. He published his results in Science magazine. Francis would go on to play important roles in the testing of the first licensed polio vaccine. Hey, we might get to the end, Bobby. We made it to 1941. They found polio virus in the digestive system. For many years, researchers had assumed that polio was a disease of the nervous system alone. Simon Flexner of the Rockefeller Institute had been especially responsible for shaping this view when he proposed that polio virus entered the human body through the nasal route. But this year, Albert Sabin and Robert Ward showed that it was very rare to find poliovirus in nasal tissues. Moreover, poliovirus was present not only in the nervous system, but in the digestive system. This meant that the virus entered through the mouth, passed into the digestive system, and was distributed by the blood to the nervous system. This finding gave hope that a vaccine could be developed that would produce antibodies to fight the virus in the bloodstream before it reached the nervous system. Any questions, guys, so far? I know it's a lot information.
You want to skip the Hanta virus?
Sure, whenever it comes around.
Oh, yeah, that's probably at the very end if you're going by a timeline.
Yeah, going by timeline.
I think that was That was back in 87 or maybe 96. I can't remember. The Hanta virus.
Yeah, I know. Excuse me. In 1941, rubella implicated in congenital defects. Australian ophthalmologist Norman McAllister Gregg noted a surprising number of infants suffering from cataracts. Wow. Gregg later overheard mothers in his waiting room discussing the cases of rubella they'd had during their pregnancies in the midst of an outbreak the year before. After further
German
investigation,
measles.
Gregg... Huh?
German measles.
Okay. Rubella.
Okay.
I know there's rubiola.
Yep. Uh-huh.
See, I had the chicken pox when I was pregnant with my youngest daughter, and it was during the first trimester. And they're not sure if that led her, because she's dyslexic with reading and with math, and she's also mentally behind. Growing up, when she was younger, you could tell she was mentally behind, like in the way she talked and acted. It took her longer. It takes her longer, I should say, to learn things. She's 26 now. And she's getting better. You could tell her spelling. And she would actually put a whole sentence backwards. From period, when she was in school, she put the period first and then put the whole entire sentence backwards. So I don't know if that had anything to contribute to what happened to her or not. But, yeah, I had chickenpox when I was pregnant. Actually, I had it, and then I found out I was pregnant afterwards. But after further investigation, Gregg linked rubella during pregnancy to congenital cataracts. His observation was the first of what eventually became a collection of reports linking rubella during pregnancy to various congenital defects. The risk of were overwhelmingly infection with rubella during the first trimester of pregnancy linked in a greater than 2 to 3 chances of a baby afflicted with congenital rubella syndrome. Of the syndrome's various symptoms and complications, ranging from blindness to heart disease to neurological abnormalities, deafness was the most common. And now, not only from illnesses, but also from mothers taking different medications can cause during that first trimester. In 1941, college graduation and graduate studies, Hillman graduated from Montana State University first in his class with a degree in chemistry and microbiology. Winning a full scholarship, Hillman soon began graduate studies in microbiology at the University of Chicago. Hillman's work focused on chlamydia, a pathogen that causes a sexually transmitted disease that can damage a woman's reproductive organs. Hillman established that chlamydia is an unusually shaped bacterium, not a virus, as had been thought. His work eventually led to the discovery of a treatment. In 1942, there was a hepatitis outbreak prompts improved vaccine safety measures. Following the use of a particular lot of the 17D vaccine among U.S. Army troops, an epidemic of hepatitis appeared. Several deaths of thousands of cases of yellow atrophy of the liver resulted. Following this incident, a similar episode in Brazil, both of which likely resulted from contaminated human blood serum being used in the vaccine. The outbreak was in Brazil and the lower part of Africa is where the outbreak was at. also the human plasma was completely removed from the 17D vaccine. Meanwhile, the disease remained endemic in parts of Africa and South America, and mosquitoes capable of spreading it were observed in parts of North America, Europe, and Australia. Like I said before during the other four shows or three shows, if you want to see all the, as I tell Lorna, all the coloring pictures, there's little videos on each of these little blurbs, and they have pictures and things like in graphs that show everything along the way from where the very first vaccine was started. Just go look up history of vaccines and .org, and it has everything. In 1944, FDR pleads a victory against polio, and his radio broadcast appeal for donations to the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. FDR likened the fight against polio to the Second World War, the dreaded disease that we battle at home, like the enemy we oppose abroad, shows no concern, no pity for the young it strikes, with its most frequent and devastating force against children. And that is why much of the future strength of America depends upon the success that we achieve in combating this disease. Not that you might not know the answer. Have there been any cases of polio since they finally got the vaccine that worked? I mean, kids still get measles.
I think polio has been eradicated.
Okay, like smallpox?
Like smallpox. But if it's still around, it's going to be usually in your third world unvaccinated countries.
Okay. Like leprosy.
But leprosy's still around. I mean, you know, especially, you know, it's just that we know how to treat it now. It's easier to treat, but we get leprosy from the armadillos here in Texas.
Okay, I was going to say in California, some of the homeless camps have had some recent outbreaks of having leprosy.
Yeah. I don't think it's only armadillos that carry it, but I know armadillos are the most common one.
Do they really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I
guess they have armadillos in Jerusalem.
That's what I was just going to say. they might have called it something else. I'm just kidding. In 1944, there was a vaccine came out for Japanese encephalitis. Maurice Hillman, working at ER Squibb and Sons, helped develop a Japanese encephalitis vaccine to protect American troops in the World War II Pacific Theater of Operations. Hillman's vaccine was never widely tested. It was given to thousands of U.S. soldiers in wartime and likely prevented disease in many of them. And later, other vaccines would replace it. In 1945, pneumococcal vaccine was largely ignored. The tetravalent pneumococcal vaccine, created with four pneumococcus types, was introduced in 1945. This vaccine, however, appeared during the advent of widespread penicillin use, when penicillin being viewed as an effective treatment for pneumococcal infections, the vaccine did not gain much attraction. In 1945, the influenza vaccine was finally approved. The first influenza vaccine was approved for military use, yet again, more guinea pigs. I'm sorry. See, they went from children to soldiers. I guess it's because it was just looked bad upon if you use children, I guess. Was used for military use in the United States in 1945 and civilian use in 1946. this whole virus inactivated influenza A and B vaccine had been tested in military recruits and college students before approval. Thomas Francis Jr. and Jonas Salk would become closely associated with the polio virus vaccine, were key investigators on much of the influenza vaccine research. Influenza vaccine developed and was high priority for the U.S. military after the death of approximately one in every 67 soldiers in the 1918-19 pandemic. I'd say so. 1946, rabies virus adapted to non-nervous tissue. At Ladurl Laboratories, physician Hillary, I can't pronounce half his name, sorry, Kaprosky adapted a rabies virus strain in chick embryos. He hoped to avoid using nervous system tissue as a medium for cultivating rabies virus because vaccine containing such tissue could cause serious side effects such as encephalitis. Additionally, he wanted to improve upon the immunogenicity of the older vaccines and to create a vaccine that would not result in as many vaccine failures as the older ones. Eventually, he would pass his virus strain through chick embryos 180 times. At that point, the virus lost its ability to sicken small animals. He would use this strain, which he called HEP, high egg passage, as he continued to work on a new rabies vaccine.
I don't know what she is. You'll have to ask her to so that you can meet the grandma.
I don't know where she is, but...
In 1947, the international campaign for tuberculosis started. A total of 8 million babies and nearly 14 million people were given the BCG vaccine in the international tuberculosis campaign, which ran through 1951. The project initially began in Europe in the aftermath of World War II. However, the program extended far beyond Europe when UNICEF contributed $2 million to expand the program to other continents.
UNICEF.
They collect change everywhere. In 1947, a massive vaccination effort began in New York. Smallpox appeared for the final time in New York City. Eugene Labar, a merchant traveling from Mexico City to Maine with his wife, arrived on the city bus, bringing the disease with him. Damn. Feeling ill, Labar went to Bellevue Hospital. 3 days later, he was transferred to the city's contagious disease hospital. He died 2 days later. Labar's death was not immediately attributed to smallpox, but when the disease appeared in two other patients who had been at the contagious disease facility at the same time, the hospital staff notified the health department. Eugene Labar's case of smallpox launched a massive vaccination program in the city. As the health department attempted to trace his steps before arriving at Bellevue Hospital and vaccinate anyone whose path he may have crossed, Health Commissioner Israel Weintz personally visited New York City Mayor William O'Dwyer to request $500,000 for the purchase of additional vaccine and to hire additional staff. O'Dwyer held a press conference in which he asked all residents who had not recently been vaccinated to be vaccinated against the disease. In the next month, 80% of the city's residents were vaccinated. Some 6.3 million people were vaccinated. In the end, the effort was judged a success by the total number of smallpox cases reached only 12, and only two people had died. Who whooping cough vaccine combined with tetanus and diphtheria in 1948. The first combined DPT, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines became available in the United States. This type of combined shot used a wholesale pertussis vaccine. Decades later, in the mid-1990s, the wholesale vaccine would be replaced with an acellular version that resulted in fewer adverse reactions. In 1948, the Kyoto disaster. In Kyoto, Japan, 66 of 606 children died after diphtheria immunization as a result of improper manufacture of toxoid. The toxoid in the preparation reverted to toxin with disastrous effects. Toxoid manufacturers instituted safeguards after this event to prevent similar incidents. And after that, it had never happened again. All right, we're almost to 1950. In 1948, there were changes in vaccine production. The newly established World Health Organization issued a report praising the freeze-dried vacuum-packed vaccine from the Vaccine Institute in Paris. Production of the vaccine soon spread around the world. Yeah, I like these little inserts. That's all it is. I try to skip some of them because they mean absolutely nothing. In 1949, there was a breakthrough in culturing viruses. In Boston, a team of John Enders and Thomas Welder and Frederick Robbins showed that they could grow polio viruses in non-nervous tissue, namely human embryonic skin and muscle tissue. This landmark finding would reduce reliance on using live monkeys for growing and testing the virus. No longer would polio research be restricted to facilities that could house large numbers of experimental animals. Enders' findings would lead the way to simpler, less expensive methods of producing large quantities of virus for studying and eventually vaccine production. Enders and his colleagues would win the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1954 for their work in culturing polio viruses. I tell you, between polio, yellow fever, and, oh, shit, Bobby, what was the other one? The other, I think they must have spent over 100 years on a few of these illnesses. I mean, after that, it's gotten faster. But I believe they spent over 100 years between yellow fever, smallpox, and polio. In 1949, Bodian finds three types of polio virus. The researchers at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine published a paper identifying three types of polio virus. Their work would be crucial for developing a vaccine, as a vaccine would have had to produce immunity to all types. The initial study was small, but further research, much of it overseen by Jonas Salk, confirmed that there were no more than three immunologically different types of polio. But I'll be damned they never say which three they are. And not one of these things they say. In 1949, there was U.S. success with vaccination. The last cases of naturally occurring smallpox in the United States developed in an outbreak limited to eight people in Hidalgo County, Texas. Oh, hold on a second. Oh, that's Hidalgo Country. My bad.
Can you repeat that?
In 1949, I'm sorry, I'm tongue-tied. It must be the friggin' dehydration in my brain. The last cases of naturally occurring smallpox in the United States developed in an outbreak limited to 8 people in Hidalgo, Texas.
County, Texas? Hidalgo, Texas?
Yeah.
The city or the county? Okay, yeah, that's pretty close to where I live.
Hidalgo, later, several
yeah,
U.S.
Hidalgo's a border town along Mexico and McAllen, Texas.
Oh, okay.
Hidalgo, yeah.
That,
so,
I was
yeah.
having a hard time. Like I said, the writing is really tiny, and I couldn't tell if it's a county or country.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, that's 30 miles from here. Hidalgo County is a county, but Hidalgo is also a city in Hidalgo County. And Hidalgo City is on the border. It's on the border of Reynosa, Mexico, and McAllen, Texas.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Several U.S. smallpox. Yes, see? You're learning something new every day.
Yes, ma'am.
Later, several U.S. smallpox infections occurred through importation from abroad and vaccination. The disease continued to appear in the rest of the world throughout the 70s. So it was done here in 49, but all right. Woohoo, 1950. In 1950, Koprowski tests polio vaccine on children. More guinea pigs, huh? Researcher Hillary Koprowski at Ladurl Laboratories conducted the first human trial of his attenuated oral polio vaccine at a New York State's facility for intellectually disabled children and children with epilepsy. He tested this type 2 vaccine developed with co-researcher Harold Cox on 20 children and demonstrated that none of them became ill with polio and all of them developed type 2 polio virus antibodies.
I can't hear.
Huh? At the time, Koprowski's methods generated considerable controversy among others who were working on experimental vaccines. Many thought that the move on testing a live vaccine in human subjects was premature, and some objected to the testing the vaccine on institutionalized children, though the practice was frequent in this era. I know, that's kind of harsh, testing it on poor kids. In 1951, I swear to God, I'm going to shoot my dog if he does not shut up. Sorry, guys. Oh, my God. Hold on 1 second, guys, while I wrangle the retards. Or not. It's hard taking care of 2 dogs, I swear. It's like having 2 children. Especially these 2 idiots.
Tell me about it. Mine are bossy.
Oh, my God. Mine's meaty. And my son's dog is just, he's bossy. Not well, we got plenty of time to change the subject for like 2 minutes. My dog, she wants to sleep under the blanket when she, that's how spoiled she is. And her way of letting me know, like when she comes into my room, is she'll scratch the blanket. Hey, move the blanket so I can get under it. Well, look, I'm sick right now and I don't friggin' move for anything. And because I didn't move fast enough, she took her fat head and started headbutting me because I wasn't moving the blanket fast enough. I'm telling you, these dogs are too smart for their own good. In 1951, a massive epidemic hit Greenland. When measles was introduced to southern Greenland, an area where the disease had not been epidemic previously, It spread rapidly. Only five people from an unprotected population of almost 5,000 escaped the disease, so that it had a final attack rate of 99.9%. However, quick efforts made in Denmark to provide gamma globulin, a type of blood protein in this case. To Greenland had some success. Patients receiving gamma globulin had a lower case fatality rate from the disease than those that didn't. Yeah, Greenland's not all that populated to begin with. In 1951, cultivation of poliovirus in monkey kidney tissue was done at the University of Pittsburgh. Jonas Salk and his team of developed a method of cultivating poliovirus in a monkey kidney tissue. The method would lead to the ability to produce large quantities of virus for vaccines. In 1952, IgG was used for polio protection. Several researchers had been investigating whether the use of human immunoglobulin, IgG, or gamma globulin could protect individuals from polio. Immunoglobulin is an antibody preparation made from blood pooled from many people who most likely have antibodies to the common infection or to common infections. Their disease-specific antibodies in the IgG, when injected into a person who had recently or would soon to be exposed to the disease, had been shown to provide protection. This type of protection is known as passive immunization. William Hammond, a University of Pittsburgh researcher, tested gamma globulin in a set of three clinical trials in 1951 to 1952. The trials were carefully constructed and used to double-blind, placebo-controlled design, one of the first of this kind. The trial showed some likely protective effects of gamma globulin used against polio. The use of preparation presented several problems, though. Gamma globulin was expensive to produce, and it gave only temporary protection. It would need to be used again in each subsequent epidemic. Moreover, physicians relied on gamma globulin for protection against measles, hepatitis, and other diseases for which there were no vaccines. The supply was limited. The need was great. As Time magazine wrote the first time, it takes almost a pint of blood to make an average shot of GG to give protection to a single polio season to all 41 million U.S. children under 15 might take 100 million shots or more. And there simply is not that much gamma globulin available, nor the blood or plasma extracted from it. Wow. That's a lot. In 1952, Salk begins early polio vaccine tests. Salk and team, with the support of the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis, began its first test on humans of their killed polio virus. The subjects were resident children of an institution for the physically and intellectually disabled. Salk tested vaccine for all three strains of polio, some in combination and some on their own. Their findings showed that the vaccine recipients produced antibodies to the virus type and the vaccine they were given. Salk's results provided some evidence on which to test larger trials. All right. We're getting there, guys. Sorry.
Can I change subject for 1 minute?
Oh, sure. Go right ahead.
What are the good viruses that we have in our body?
The good viruses?
Yeah.
I know you have to have the normal flora in your gut.
I'm having
a brain fart.
One of the good ones in the gut is called the norovirus. One of the really good ones. And another one, people don't think of it as a virus, but it is. It's called a bacteriophage.
Oh, okay.
And a bacteriophage helps with your immune systems because it eats viruses. And then there's another one that they discovered. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it helps to identify cancer cells, and they kind of use those. You see, it's actually a herpes virus. There's a latent herpes virus, which means it's non-symptomatic. It can help natural killer cells identify cancer cells. And so that's a good one. And one more virus. This is a recent virus that they found that people with HIV who are infected with this virus actually live longer. And I'm trying to find out the name of it. I can't remember what it's called. We're talking about all the bad viruses that are killing people, cause epidemics and pandemics and need for vaccines and things. But, you know, you get too many vaccines going on, you might actually damage some of the good viruses that you might have in your system. And that's the same thing. If you give a woman an antibiotic, well, it kills the good bacteria in the gut, and now she gets all of the flora in the gut, and she gets a yeast infection, you know?
Yeah.
And so then you have to treat the yeast infection. And so, there's a good balance of what they call the flora, which is like your yeast and other things, and then the fauna, which is like your bacteria. So the flora and the fauna of your intestinal tract can be damaged by viruses, overgrowth or bacterial overgrowth, and just know that not all viruses are bad. Developing kids, they need viruses to get their immune system going. It's just these really, really, really bad viruses are the ones that they want to be getting vaccines for, and obviously the ones we have vaccines for are really bad, as you're describing them as we go through time.
Oh yeah. One other one, H. pylori. They thought that I had that. I end up with gastritis, not H. pylori.
Everybody has H. pylori.
But it can get out of control.
Exactly. H. pylori is a bacteria that is a virus. I mean H. pylori is a bacteria. It's not a virus. H. pylori is a bacteria that is an acid fast.
It's a bacteria.
Yeah.
No, because I know with H. pylori, you got what, three antibiotics that you got to take.
There's two antibiotics three antibiotics and an antacid. I mean, it's a cocktail. And they can eradicate. They can eradicate it, but it can come back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the problem with the H. pylori, once it overgrows in the gut, it can lead to ulcers or perforations in the lining of the stomach, and that's why it can become bad. A lot of our children who really, really enjoy those hot Cheetos and those spicy potato chips are getting these H. pylori infections because, for some reason, the peppers associated with that increases the acidity of stomach, and so the H. pylori can overgrow because it loves acid, whereas the other stuff that keeps everything in balance can't be as effective when the acid's really high in the stomach. So if you got kids who are getting gastritis from eating too many spicy foods and hot Cheetos and things, get them off of it.
Oh, you could get gastritis from more than just Cheetos.
So
I have chronic gastritis.
Tomato. You can get it just from simple tomato. Yeah.
Oh,
tomato sauce.
Were you on at the very beginning of the show?
I heard you saying about how severe your gastritis was, like when I first got on, and that was it. But I didn't hear the very beginning of the story.
Oh no, I've got it bad. I've got chronic gastritis. I've had it 10 times since last January, 8 times last year, and 2 so far this year. And this year is so bad that I haven't eaten in 4 days. I was telling Bobby, I finally got to eat 2 eggs this morning, scrambled eggs, just plain, nothing on it. And then I ate a half a chicken breast that was cooked in a crock pot, plain. And it was a little too much. I should have eaten a little bit less. But I have to, as of right now, I have to cut out, the obvious. I don't eat French fries. I don't eat fried foods and fast foods and all that crap. But I have to stop eating cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, rutabaga, sauerkraut, peppers, onions, cabbage, corn, and coconut. And I can't have nuts or seeds, really upset about.
Are you on what they call a FODMAP diet?
I have no idea what it's called.
There you go.
It just says foods to avoid, foods to consider.
Oh, a FODMAP diet. You might want to look it up. A lot of gastroenterologists are suggesting that, along with a Mediterranean diet, but that ain't going to work for you because it's a lot of nuts and berries.
Oh, okay.
FODMAP.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I don't even know. Well, because I have celiac, and it's a constant, and they think that's why I constantly have. But now I also have to stop eating white rice and potatoes as well.
You need to be on a high probiotic.
High probiotic? Okay.
Yep. You need a high lactobacillus probiotic.
Okay.
And
that's
going to restore
it.
Yeah,
one
of the main causes of disease in people is inflammation of the gut or a leaky gut syndrome, where they're not absorbing the nutrients they need, and second of all, they can't take in some of the nutrients that they need because they can't tolerate it, like celiac and lactose and other things like that.
Oh, lactose intolerant, which I am lactose intolerant.
Yeah.
Come to find out, I was not born with celiac. They said that women over 40 who are lactose intolerant usually end up with celiac, and that's what happened to me. But lactose intolerance runs in my family.
Everybody is lactose intolerant. Doctor hasn't told you to get on a probiotic.
It's the VA. They're retarded.
My VA GI recommended me to get on a probiotic with the lactobacillus, the height. It's evidence-based.
Now, I'm going to have to go see a GI doctor. But here's my problem. The last couple months, every time I eat, my stomach swells. And I don't care how healthy it is, it doesn't matter. Like I can have grilled chicken and vegetables and this, that, and the other. My stomach swells. Well, I didn't know it was the broccoli, the cauliflower, because I get the mixed vegetables, you know, the
what is it? Is it,
and all
is
that.
It gas, is it gaseous distension or what? You mean when you mean swells?
It's hard as a rock. And then eventually it goes down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's made it progressively worse. That and eating potatoes, but I boil them or I'll bake them. And so the only kind I can eat is sweet potatoes or brown rice. But I noticed my vitamins that I've been taking were not gluten-free. So I had to go hunt down gluten-free vitamins. And so a lot of things. And then when they gave me the inevitable GI cocktail, which is the greatest thing on earth, but when they gave it to me, it took forever to work, and my stomach literally felt like fire. It was on fire. And so now I have – and I took it three times. I took it once yesterday and three times yesterday, and now it's gone from my stomach to my intestines. So it's water. So
yeah, well,
created
the GI cocktail, like the Maalox, like you were saying, that's one thing. But it's just a simple baking soda. Put 2 teaspoons in water. You know, in a 4-ounce glass of water, 2 teaspoons of baking soda, and that'll neutralize the acid in your stomach right away.
Seriously?
Yeah. Well, look at the ingredients on Alka-Seltzer. You have a computer in front of you right now, right?
Yeah.
Well, what is Alka-Seltzer? What is the main ingredient in Alka-Seltzer?
I don't know. What is Alka-Seltzer? Yeah, if I could spell it.
And then after that, look at what's the main ingredient in baking soda.
Not alcohol.
Not alcohol. No, sir.
Well, they're effervescent. I'm looking for the one that has what it is. Oh, good Lord. Yeah, I didn't know that. If I would have known that, damn it, I wouldn't have. Because, hey, now my intestines are cleaned out. That's all I know. I feel like I drank a bottle of Mag citrate.
Yeah, you don't want to do that either, because that'll clean you out too. And next thing you know, you got diaper rash.
Oh, I think I'm beyond that.
So get some Dr. Smith. And or
what?
You get Dr. Smith, or you get those flushable wipes.
Oh yeah, yep. I hate to say, like I told everybody, TMI. I know bleeding from going so much. So I'm not. Now that I know that, I'll just go get me some baking soda. Good God.
Well, yeah, sodium bicarbonate.
Sodium bicarb.
Yeah, sodium bicarb. It's a base. You know, there's an acid and then there's a base. Acid and alkaline.
Anhydrous citric acid.
Yeah, well, that too, but that's Alka-Seltzer. But if you look at the ingredients on baking soda, it's sodium bicarbonate.
So
basically, they put that anhydrous citric acid in it just to keep that tablet together, and so it does that little fizzle in it when you put it in the water. The plop, plop, fizz, fizz thing with the Alka-Seltzer. But 2 teaspoons of baking soda is the same as 2 little Alka-Seltzer tablets. And in an emergency, drink it. And it should neutralize your acid, like, right away. If not, drink another glass.
Now,
and that,
this
that,
is telling
that's
me,
an at-home remedy for GI cocktail.
Well, see, I didn't know. I needed to clean my intestines out anyway because apparently I haven't been going enough. Which a lot of the distension of my abdomen is gone, which is a good thing.
Well, we did talk about liver, right? Detoxing the liver and detoxing the kidneys. We talked a little bit about that on one of the shows.
Yeah.
So basically that's what you're doing. You're just cleaning out the gut. But the thing is when you do that, when you basically you're killing off.
Yeah.
The
good
bacteria
or the good stuff.
And then the fungus is overgrowing in the gut, leading to that osmotic flow that you got.
Now,
so you need that,
why?
You need that happy balance.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So now this is telling me that I have to give up pickles, mustard, and ketchup, and barbecue sauce.
Well,
Is it the vinegar?
Exactly. That's the thing that's in all three of them. And what is vinegar? Vinegar is an acid.
Oh yeah, true. Yeah.
Vinegar is basically what your stomach acid is. They're basically like the same molecular structure. Vinegar and if you want to see how something's going to digest in your stomach, you stick it in vinegar.
Yeah. I mean, I don't eat a whole lot of pickles, or I hardly ever use mustard. I mean, that's like one of those use common sense. Don't just like drink a whole bottle of mustard. I mean, I get that. But, I really do. I aside of what I'm already doing, I have to cut even more stuff out. And is fish a problem? Like tilapia, stuff like that to bake it? Would that be okay?
Not if it's baked. It's okay if it's baked. Baked
okay.
fish is good for you because baked fish is high in your omega-3s.
No, I just want to make sure because, you know, there's so much that I can't eat now, and it's like we eat ground beef or Angus once a month, if that. We don't eat pork, so we don't eat fried food. We don't eat out, so I need something else.
Well, when you eat foods that have a high sodium content, such as processed meats and things like that. Now, if you know, you go back to your basic chemistry, sodium, which is Na.
Yeah.
It's a plus. It's an Na plus molecule. It's a positive cation, which is basically anything that's plus is going to be considered acid. Chloride is a minus molecule, so anything that's sodium chloride is going to be a plus and a minus, and they kind of stick together because they're magnetic. But once your system breaks it down, sodium is much stronger than the chloride. And so the acid content from using anything that's high in salt is going to be people who have gastritis, especially chronic gastritis. So any foods that have a high salt content, high sodium content, such as your processed meats, bologna, some of the hams, things like that.
Anyway. Yeah, I can't eat those anyway because they have gluten in them.
And then you eat fish and you just want to stick a bunch of salt and pepper on it just to give it flavor or change the flavor. You know, adding those additional is what's not recommended. That's all I'm saying. I'm just trying to explain to you why. Because the sodium
I understand. Why? Now, see, and there's a couple things in here that I don't understand. And I know right now while my stomach is inflamed and things like that, to avoid nuts and seeds, why popcorn? Would it be the same thing, or because it's corn and it's a laxative?
I honestly don't know answer to that. I don't know anything about. All I know is popcorn never had any nutritional value, so why even bother with it? The only way popcorn can be good is with a lot of salt and butter. You know, plain popcorn
I eat plain popcorn. I eat plain white popcorn. That didn't bother me. That's why I was kind of like, why can't I eat a plain? And then did they put peanut butter on here? Because that kind of threw me off, too, was the peanut butter. Like, I could go to the low-fat peanut butter, but if there's only 2 grams of saturated fat and nothing else, where is the fat coming from? The actual peanuts itself or... It says I can eat peanut butter as long as it's not doesn't have the nuts in it, like the chunky peanut butter.
Not the chunky peanut butter? Yeah, I honestly don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's the stuff that they put in the peanut butter to make it give it that creamy.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I'll probably just go to the low-fat peanut butter. It's not a big deal. I'm the only one that eats it besides the dogs. They get their own jar of peanut butter.
Well, you with your gastritis, you definitely need a high probiotic, and you also need a high fiber diet. And if you can't get the fiber through your diet, then you need to take supplements like a Metamucil or something like that.
So high probiotic.
That will clean your gut out. And, you know, once your gut's cleaned out, you'll start absorbing your nutrients better and you'll start feeling better. A lot of the even, like, arthritis pain will go away just because of inflammation from the gut. Gut inflammation is one of the underlying causes of many, many chronic illnesses, and people just doesn't realize
it. Oh, yeah. So you said high probiotic and what?
And fiber.
Oh, fiber, okay.
Fiber and a high lactobacillus count of a probiotic. But they can become real costly and expensive, and so most people, they'll just do something simple yogurt, but then the lactose intolerant can't do that.
No, I know. Now, I did notice there was a difference between the Greek yogurt and regular yogurt. The Greek yogurt doesn't make me sick. So,
well, the Greek yogurt is the one with the probiotics in it.
Oh, okay. That's probably why.
Mm-hmm.
But then we take lactose.
It's not just any yogurt. Yeah, it's just not any yogurt. You got to get the yogurt with the probiotic in it. But then you can take the probiotic supplement if you can't tolerate the yogurt. So fascinating.
Yeah,
but yeah, try the
Alka-Seltzer
trick, and if it works for you, let me know, okay?
Oh, I will. The other, what was the other thing? I can't even think of it. I'm kind of brain dead. But yeah, the vitamins, I had to switch to the Centrum because it's the, one of the Centrum brands is gluten-free. All of the other brands have gluten in them. So.
Well.
And they're not too bad. They're not too bad. The only drawback is the iodine. And I'm allergic to iodine.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah.
Yeah, iodinized salt ain't going to be good for you either then.
Oh, I don't use iodized salt.
Yeah.
I use non-iodized salt or the pink Himalayan, but I don't use much salt anyway.
Well, regardless,
yeah,
like I said, the sodium is still an acid, and that's not good for people with gastritis, right?
Yeah. And I found out there's four stages to the different types of gastritis, and I'm like, yay. Right now I'm at the bottom. I'm at chronic. And then it goes all the way up to the type that bleeds to where you can hemorrhage. So.
Wow.
That's if it lasts for 6 months or more.
Yeah, they call that PUD, right? Peptic ulcer disease. But
atrophic or whatever. I can't think of
atrophic, right?
Gastritis. But that's the worst one. You have it where it's you can get it all the time, and then there's another stage. It's a little like when it can last up to 3 months, and then there's 6 months or less, or 6 months or more, and that's the bad one.
Chronic, acute, subacute.
Yep.
Yep. But yeah, it's...
And unfortunately, I have the chronic.
Well, the other thing I was going to tell you when we were talking about vitamins, I don't know if I brought this up, but if you're going to purchase vitamins, the best vitamins to purchase are the capsular form of vitamins. When they break open the capsules, it's in the granules.
Yeah.
Because the pill form of the vitamin, it also has a lot of phthalates in it, and psyllium and plastic and other things that kind of keep that in a pill form, so that the best form of the vitamin is going to be the capsular form, and that's going to be definitely the most expensive form. So, but vitamins, you know, vitamin A is vitamin A is vitamin A, but that's not true. It's how your body can absorb it, and the best absorbed ones are always going to cost you more money.
We've come to figure that one out the hard way.
Yeah.
Why healthier
and
stuff has to cost more?
Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, hey, work on fixing your gut, and I bet a lot of your illness is going to go away. Even the celiac can reverse itself.
Even if the cilia is flat?
It can still grow back.
It can?
Yes, it can. Smokers. They have cilia on the back of their throat going down their trachea. And what that cilia's job to do is to bring up phlegms to keep it out of the lungs. That's why a smoker has a cough every day. He's always coughing up that little bitty phlegm ball that's trying to go down his throat. The normal person who doesn't smoke, the cilia does the job for them by keeping the trachea clear so it's not going down into the lungs. Well, the smokers, they kind of, for lack of a better word, burn off the cilia in their trachea. Cilia means little fingers. They're little fingers that wiggle, and they're pushing things up the trachea to keep it out of the lungs. So after you quit smoking, after you quit smoking within... I think it's 3 to a year. I can't remember exactly. I'm just guessing here, so don't quote me. The cilia can grow back.
I heard that if your celiac is severe, that the cilia will not grow back. So I don't know. I'll have to ask them because...
You have to treat the underlying cause of the problem, and once you correct that, what caused them to go flat to begin with, and then treat the underlying cause of the problem, and the good chance is they will grow back.
Yeah, but
there's nothing definitive that they won't grow back. It's just that most people don't change their lifestyle, so it doesn't normally happen.
Yeah, but if you're – but see, there's different types of celiac. There's celiac intolerance, celiac sprue. I forgot the other one was. But I'm actually allergic to gluten, wheat, barley, rye. I can never eat it again. See, that's how, one, it could get fixed. but the actual autoimmune part will never go away. But the effects, that's what I'm hoping can go away. Like the cilia being flat.
All right, we got 3 minutes.
You should text me your email. I could send you some information for you to read. You'd be surprised.
Okay.
You'd be surprised. Yeah.
So. Cool.
Probably give text her my number.
I will.
And then she can text me her email, and then I'll send her some information, and she can fix herself.
Yep.
I pretty much am now without the VA's help.
Hey, so is that girl from Wisconsin still on here?
She's sleeping,
Wisconsin?
Probably.
Yeah, I'm not sleeping.
Yeah, I'm not sleeping. I'm just drunk.
I'm not.
I'm going to be sleeping.
Well, it was a great show, as usual, Miss Kimberly. Phil, thanks for dropping in with us.
You're welcome.
Lorna, as always, pleasure having you to pick on.
Of course. What I do best.
God bless America. God bless our kids, our troops, first responders, our veterans, and God bless the Defender 7. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
God bless you guys. Live well and be good to each other.
You too, brother.